Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey everybody, Fiona here, and welcome to another episode of Stepping Into Frame, our podcast all about women in screenwriting here at the Script Department. You can check out what our global pitch of screenwriters is up to by following thescriptdepartment.net or find us anywhere you get your podcasts. And today I'm joined again by Lorna. Hi, Lorna.
Hi.
And we are talking about, it's a very upbeat opening to this conversation on probably not such an upbeat movie. Today we are talking about The Luckiest Girl Alive. So we've both got our calming teas with us. What was your first thoughts? What's your kind of elevator reaction, if you like?
Well, I mean, we need a trigger warning for rape, don't we? It is quite intensely gone into, isn't it, in the storyline and the kind of impact that that had. But I felt like compared to Blonde, which you guys obviously were talking about, Mila Kunitz's character, Annie, she had so much more agency.
Yes.
And obviously, I don't know if you know, but the writer, Jessica Knoll, she actually based it on her own experiences of being gang raped. Yeah. So
That's tough.
Why it was so harrowing. I mean, it's always harrowing, but I think that there were certain details that she put in there from her own personal experiences. So it was extra.
Yeah, that's really tough. Because interesting, I thought it was interesting. So Jessica Knoll, the film came from her debut novel. I mean, that's pretty impressive to have your debut novel turned into a screenplay. And she wrote the screenplay, which is doubly impressive and makes me doubly jealous. But but in terms of that is such a terrible story. I didn't know that. I had heard it was based on some sort of real life events, but I wasn't sure the detail of it. So that is quite an interesting lens then to view the rest of the film. So what was your kind of overarching, how did you feel at the end of it, for example?
Well, because often, we get to see rape so many times as women. It's particularly traumatic that it's there again and again in cinema and in TV. We're just kind of assaulted with it through our screens so often. And so my initial reaction was like, not again. It's almost like the TV and the film is kind of making it, it's not an if it happens to you, it's like when it happens to you. It's how much it's always just seems to be coming at us again and again. But and things like, there were films like Red Sparrow where it's almost, it is part of her origin story getting raped, and this film is absolutely not like that. In fact, the way that they handle it is that she doesn't actually, she's not able to properly move forwards in her life until she's able to process through what happened to her and come to terms with it. And that's when it moves beyond it and is able to kind of succeed and make choices for herself that aren't for other people. And she's constantly people pleasing and that validation in all sorts of different areas.
Yeah, it was very, it was quite fascinating to see that duality of character. So she is, I mean, yes, absolutely loads more agency, like massive agency compared to, you know, Marilyn in the Blonde movie. I thought it was really fascinating the way she was so unlikable. On her inner monologue was actually really unpleasant, but she was such a people pleaser on the outside. And it kind of intrigued me, that idea of a character, because we often talk about character, don't we? And, you know, is it okay to make an unpleasant character? And I've got a bit of a chip on my shoulder about the industry's general unhappiness with unlikable women. Like, we don't really like stories about difficult women as protagonists. It's something that, and that might be, I think John Finnegan has told me that it's a chip that's on my shoulder and I need to get over it. But I kind of still have this thing that I think it is harder to sell characters that are women protagonists who are unpleasant. And so, and she's not unpleasant to most people, but she's got that really hard edge, and certainly her inner monologues really quite nasty. Like some of the things she says to a mum, you know, it's really kind of tough. And so it was kind of intriguing to me how she was set up as being really kind of, it was hard to kind of jump on the, what was her name? Arnie.
Yeah.
The Arnie train. Yeah, the end of Tiffany, wasn't it? Yeah. For me, certainly at the beginning, but then progressively, and I guess that's the whole idea of the narrative structure, isn't it? By the time it unfolds and you see what happens to her, your whole perspective of it changes, and you get this deep understanding of why she's why she is as she is. How did you find her as her character?
Well, there were so many little red herrings that were showing that were kind of inferring that she was going to end up being an unreliable character with an unreliable narrative. And I was just like, I was so on edge about that. I was like, please no, don't let it be another story about, and it didn't really happen. I mean, so often, again, it's the kind of poor boys that get blamed, like that are massively in the minority, which, you know, it does happen that there are obviously rapes that are made up, and people who are imprisoned and blamed unfairly, but the vast majority of cases never get to even the police, let alone to court and ending up going through. And so I was just like, I don't need to see this. But in actual fact, I feel like that was the writer Jessica Knoll trying to almost interrogate us as a viewer and interrogate our own prejudices. So so when picking up on those unreliable narrative hints, be like, oh yeah, of course she's made up, of course, like, and she'll have gone around shooting everyone, and not that I'd have blamed her, to be honest, if she'd have
I know
when it was in her hands. And so I was like, phew, it was slightly traumatic to be like fed that red herring, but I was relieved the fact that actually that's not what the story was about, and it was about the fact that she barely believed herself. Let alone anyone else.
And it was set up to us kind of really in that early, that one of the first scenes where she was at school and she was handed back her essay that she wrote about Holden Caulfield. And, you know, the teacher says to her, it's a fantastic essay about the unreliable narrator of Holden Caulfield. And so you go, ah, okay, so this is what we've got here. We've got this unreliable narrator. And also, I think it was the very first scene where she's with her fiance and they're shopping for knives, and then the knife turns and it gets all violent. I thought at the beginning, because when I kind of coupled those two things together, the unreliable narrator and the kind of psychopath, I thought we had another American Psycho on our hands, like the movie American Psycho. I thought, okay, this girl is actually going to be a is going to be a killer. I thought that's what we had. So it was sort of interesting the way it turned, and I quite liked the way it became something really unexpected. I hadn't read anything before I watched it, just to sort of colour my view. So yeah, it was kind of good the way it went off that way, I think, and took us into another spin. Tell me, there's so many things I want to ask you about. Tell me about, okay, maybe I'll come at it this way. The boys, the perpetrators of the crime, there are a couple of things I've grappled with a little bit in this bit. And it was about the fact that because I think one of the things, okay, I need to articulate myself a little bit better. Hang on, let me start again. So if I think about one of the themes of the film, or one of the themes that was important to Arnie, and one of the things that she tackled was her feeling about unworthiness, and particularly from a financial point of view, she felt like, because she was a scholarship kid in this big private school with all everyone else that was rich and she wasn't, and she really felt that, she really carried that right through her life. I thought she still hung on to it at the end, and we'll come back to that because I want to kind of talk about the end state a little bit later, and how she sets up the sort of her ideal life going forward, but we'll get back to that. But from the boys' point of view, just comparison to Moxie. In Moxie, when in the Moxie movie, there's the high school, the antagonist, if you like, is this hot, wealthy guy who is untouchable. And in this movie, we had also a group of boys that she said were untouchable. That was actually the word she used in the piece. But I didn't feel like that came across very strongly, that they were actually those kind of characters. I felt a little bit like they were a bit muddled up. There was a bit of time where I couldn't quite work out who was who of those friends.
They all looked the same.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
I wondered who was who. Like,
exactly. Yeah. And that was really noticeable, wasn't it? So yeah. Do you think that was deliberate? I was talking to my husband about this today, and I thought, do you reckon that was, because it was, to me, very striking if I compare it to Moxie, which is similarly, well, the whole movie's about the high school kind of, and the guy that is sort of sexually harasses one of the other girls, and he gets called out for it, and there's rape and blah, blah, blah. And it's a very different kind of film, but it's really sets up very clearly from the beginning that this boy is the kind of school hero, and he wins all the sports competitions and everybody loves him. And but it wasn't very strong here. It was actually very subtle and actually quite hard to work out who was that one guy that was responsible, you know. And I thought maybe was that, do you think that was a mechanic of the director and or the screenwriter to kind of blur this sort of idea of just a generally revolting, entitled male character?
Yeah, maybe.
What do you think?
Maybe. I hadn't really thought about that. I just thought it was me. Yeah.
Well, I thought it was me too. So yeah. Then I thought, okay, well, maybe there's a reason. I always like to check myself and go, okay, was that really a problem or did you just miss something? Which is, you know, quite often the case. Okay, interesting. So then off the back of that, this whole idea about wealth was something that she kind of liked and didn't like. And there was that seminal moment, wasn't there, after the school shooting where she went back to school and they went on the excursion and she was going up the steps of the building, art gallery, something, and the woman was walking down the stairs and she was like on a phone and she looked beautiful and she was everything that Arnie went, I want to be that. And she kind of, that's what she became, right? But then in the end, she didn't reject that, which I also thought was interesting. She didn't actually, like, she rejected her rich boyfriends, but she still didn't, reject that lifestyle ultimately, did she?
Yeah.
She just sort of went.
Yeah.
Did is it
but her character
did you notice that or
her character development was more about her taking control of her life and not trying to please everyone. So she was trying to figure out what was what she wanted.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And what was what other people wanted for her? Because obviously she had a mum pushing her into this Ivy League lifestyle. Get yourself a rich boyfriend and then you'll be set up for life. And then obviously there's the boys that she was trying to please by apologizing to them and feeling like it was her fault and not being sure about what happened and not saying what happened and worrying about what her mum would think. And obviously her mum wasn't very supportive when she did find out. And so it was all like so much of her thought process was about what other people will think and what other people want her to do. And so that was what she rejected at the end, rather than it being about money and power and a position. It was about her own choices and knowing what she wanted.
I guess that's probably true, although I kind of hoped that the kind of self, like the going through that process of working through the trauma, the choices that she'd made for this whole kind of, because the lifestyle of everybody around her was really shallow. That whole New York, you know, all about money, all about status, all about what you look like, all about how much you're earning. It's so vacuous, right? But so even though she wanted to be a writer, she still went for the New York Times magazine, right? She still went for the kind of, I've become a viral sensation right at the end. And I kind of was surprised about that. I kind of hoped, I think, that she would have rejected that completely and just gone a whole different direction. And so, but you're probably right. It was probably less about the rejection of her environment and more about her listening to herself, I guess, and working out who she really was, I guess.
I think trying to expect a New Yorker to kind of step back and go, hey, this whole culture in New York is a bit crap. It's a lot to expect.
Yeah, who needs it? I'm going to become a hippie. Yeah, I'm going to go and buy a van and travel around and buy a dog and surf for the rest of my life. Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. It's probably too big an expectation. But, I thought that was kind of, it kind of intrigued me a little bit. So what did you think about, like, characters and structure? What were the sorts of things that hit you about the piece?
Her mum, I can't remember the actress's name, but the actress who played her mum was brilliant. I've seen her in Friday Night Lights and she's just brilliant. She was an incredible actress. Obviously, Mila Kunis is an incredible actress. And the girl who played the younger Arnie, that must have been really traumatic. And they did have an intimacy coordinator to help her with those scenes. And I was reading about how the director had like basically written contracts for each of the different scenes that they were going to film. So talking to the actor and saying, okay, what are you comfortable with? And then them talking it through and then writing a contract to say, this is what you've said you're okay with. This is what we're definitely not going to do. So this is how it's going to go down and it won't deviate from this, which I think is brilliant. I can't imagine what it's like for a kid having to be in that scene, and it must be traumatizing just to act.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She did an incredible job, didn't she?
She really did.
I'm just trying to look up her name because she was quite amazing, I thought, really, because it is, I think it's definitely something you need to dig deep to be able to emotionally manage that. And she was absolutely incredible. And her name is Chiara Aurelia. So she played the young Arnie. Yeah, she was absolutely fantastic, I thought, handled it really well. I did think, and I felt this was a, I think this was a weakness in the script, was the use of two characters I thought made perfect sense. But I felt like there was little connection between the characters. Like there was really nothing about them that was, you could tell they were the same person. I mean, obviously they're different actors, but that aside, in terms of the characterization, I felt that was a bit weak because the young Arnie, she was very, very, very passive. And even though the mum had mentioned it later on at the, in the kind of denouement at the, towards the end there, where the mum and Arnie get together and have it out really on that jetty. And the mum says, oh, well, you know, you were never listening to me. You did whatever you wanted. And it kind of made out that she was a bit of a rebel, but that didn't really come through. And certainly that, you know, it just felt a bit disconnected for me.
Yeah, because that wasn't what she was doing. She wasn't rebelling. She was going along with the crowd. That was her, again, acquiescing to what everybody else wanted.
Yes, exactly.
Her doing it and act, like having any agency in that moment.
Yeah, definitely. And I felt that she was there could have just been, it's almost like you needed a continuity person for the character, you know, because even that inner monologue, I mean, tried to reconcile it within myself and thought, okay, well, is that because she's been traumatized? Do you have that kind of a fundamental character shift pre going through two incredibly traumatic events? I mean, one of those events is life-changing, let alone two within a short period of time. And I thought, well, maybe the character did, maybe she did just harden up. Maybe she did get that tough internal monologue because of what she's been through. I don't know. So, and maybe it was that, but it did just strike me a little bit as a bit, oh, okay, felt a little bit odd. What else have you got to talk about? What were your thoughts?
Talking about the gun shooting. So they got Sandy Hook promised to read all the versions of the script from a gun violence point of view, making sure that was realistic. So obviously she was drawing on her own experience, although she didn't admit that to start off with. She would just say to people that she did research. It took her, she wrote a really, really good essay that's worth looking at that is on Lenny Letter. There's a website called Lenny Letter, and so she wrote an essay. So there are some strong similarities between Annie's character and how she handled it and Jessica herself and how she handled it. And she worked for Cosmopolitan. And so there's all this, like, the trajectory that their lives went on. There are lots and lots of similarities as well.
Mm. It's really interesting. It's quite a big call, isn't it, to write something like that that you've been through, that is so incredibly personal, and put it in that forum. It's quite something. I don't think I could do that. It would be too much, I think, to do that kind of exposure of the self. And it's interesting because the film has had some rough reviews. I don't know if you've
I haven't seen any.
Yeah, it's had a few rough reviews. Some of them are around things like some of the reviews took quite a umbrance, if you like, with the fact that she used it's the combination of the high school shooting and the gang rape. And one review said that they felt like the high school gun violence issue that had happened because of it was used as a backdrop to kind of just put the gang rape story against, if you like, and that was not a good choice, which I thought was interesting. That didn't strike me, but I thought that was interesting. Someone else talked about the the again, the money thing, and how the Arnie character, her anger manifests to the mother in only about her social class. And that even though Arnie ends up with this kind of, well, I'm going to be who I am now and not listen to everybody, she still jibed at her mother right up until the end about, you know, she had a go at her at the beginning about, well, they were teasing her about where she shopped, where she bought her clothes, but she also was, I think, about her shoes and how she pronounced words and stuff. And I thought that was a bit of a shame, actually, because it made us less, or certainly made me less empathetic towards her as a character, because I wasn't sure I really liked her.
No, but, you know? But I think that was probably deliberate, particularly at the start. And just to make us like really be like, she's clearly not everything that she seems, because the person that we're seeing is very different to the person that she's presenting with this beautiful life and shopping for knives.
So what do you think, what decision making do you think went on there? So what was the purpose of setting her up as unpleasant? Was that to inside and then, you know, people pleasing on the outside? Was that to show the disconnect of the trauma she was experiencing, do you think?
I think probably to some extent, and also the fact to really highlight how much she is people pleasing, because this is what she thinks and this is what she's doing, which showing the extreme distance between the two. But also I think it was a device just to make us go, oh, I don't like her. Is she going to get her comeuppance? That kind of take us off in that direction. And whether or not that she was trying to get people to root against her before they start to realise, oh, actually, she is deserving of my sympathy. And
So was it, do you think it was a device about, let's make people not like her, and then slowly as we unfold what she's gone through, people will start to feel bad themselves about how they've judged her because of how she is or something? I don't know.
I think that's what the journey that she was trying to take us on as a reader or a viewer.
I don't know. How did you feel at the end? Did you feel bad that you, or maybe did you, were you empathetic from the start?
I never do that with films. I never have a like, oh, I don't like this person kind of, I like, oh, I'm intrigued by this person, I'm now going to kind of get to know them.
Right.
And so, yeah, I wait until the end before I decide.
Oh, that's cheating. You've got to go with it. I see, I'm the opposite. I'm like, I'm right in there. And because I've got this big thing, as I rattle on about all the time, you know, like about difficult characters. I've got this thing about trying to make difficult characters have some redemption quality about them, so that even though they are difficult, you still engage with them as a character. And I'm not sure that I actually engaged with Arnie enough to feel the kind of empathy that I think I could have felt if her characterization was structured a little bit differently. So, and if you think about, like, I always think my great example of this is Sea of Love. Have you ever seen that movie? Yes, I'm not surprised. It was made in the 1970s. It's like when, you know, nobody was around to see this. I've gone on this Al Pacino retrospective because I'm completely obsessed with Al Pacino. And it was an Al Pacino movie, and from a long time ago, like somewhere in the 70s. And basically, and this example gets used a bit in, is it something like, it's in Save the Cat, you know, Blake Snyder's book, Save the Cat? It might be there, or some other book around characterization. And I think it's a superb example. So you're in New York. Al Pacino's character is the head of the police department. There's a whole bunch of outstanding warrants for a whole bunch of criminals that live in New York City. So they set up a sting. And the sting is they send out a letter to all of the criminals where they know they live, and they say, come down to like City Hall or something like that. on this day, and you get to meet the Yankees. We're going to, you know, come and meet the Yankees baseball team. They are baseball, aren't they?
Yeah.
Sorry. If anyone's American watching this going, oh my God, wait, no, no, no. Anyway, I think they are. So the promise was come down, meet the Yankees.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Great. And so what happens is, of course, all the criminals go down there, they're in City Hall, and the idea is a sting happens and the police arrest them all, right? Great idea. So you kind of, it starts with the film where you go, actually, yeah, that's a really effective policing approach, but God, that's a bit rough, isn't it? Like, that's not very nice at all. So the guy that, so Pacino is the guy that heads this up. You're a bit like, is he a nice guy? I don't know. I don't think he's that nice a guy. So this thing happens just before the sting happens. So Pacino's outside with his car, at his car having a cigarette or coffee or something, I don't know. This guy runs down the street holding his little boy's hands, and he goes, you know, I'm late. I'm here to see the Yankees. I've got my note, you know, I'm ready. Where are they? I'm running late. And Pacino sees he's got his little boy, and he just says to him something about, oh no, it's been cancelled, and really slowly flashes his police badge. Really? So the guy goes, oh, okay. And so the guy goes, right? So that's your kind of save your cat moment, right? Or your okay. So it's your redemptive quality, right? So then you go, okay, well, now we're on Pacino's side, because we know that he's just doing his job and he's got a heart and he's got some integrity, you know? And I just don't know whether I struggle to get that with Arnie. I struggle to feel that, and it was because of her internal monologue, and that was quite rough and quite nasty, that I was like, actually, is there anything else? And also, and I don't know what your thoughts are, I thought her relationship with her fiance was terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it had its moments, and he was a little bit too perfect. I mean, he's a slightly too dimensional as far as like male characters are concerned. So, yeah, she was really awful to him, really, and he was very.
Well, they were pretty awful to each other, weren't they? I mean, they were. It was. I was like, God, I would hate that, because, you know, one minute it was great, and the next minute it was terrible, and then it was great, and all was forgiven, and the next minute it was terrible. And I don't know whether maybe I'm just getting old, but I was like, I couldn't deal with that relationship. Too much. But he was, you're right, I think he was very one-dimensional, and he was also very stereotypical. You know, she goes away for a night to do her interview for the documentary, and there he is with his mates watching football, and, you know, and I was like, oh, please, you know, like, you know. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting kind of combination, and a bit, again, maybe just a missed opportunity. What about the teacher? What did you think about the teacher?
Well, again, that was another kind of slight misdirect, because you were thinking, oh, is there going to be something going on here? What's that going to be about? And in some ways, there were some unnecessary misdirects. I don't think it was necessary for you to be like, oh, did something happen that shouldn't have happened between the two of them? Or maybe that was just me kind of jumping to conclusions. I think it's okay to have teachers who are just nice, and you can go to them and they will do the right thing. And then obviously the headmaster was awful, but the teacher.
And he still got fired.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Which was a bit sad, but yeah, it was a red herring, wasn't it, for us, which was, I feel like he was underutilized as a character. I would have liked to have seen more of him in there, because I think the bit that really intrigued me was early on when he re-met the teacher, when she re-met him at that restaurant, and because you're trying to piece things together backwards, right? When he comes in, and that there was a really interesting dynamic between them, and the conversation was really interesting, and And I kind of thought, oh, it really intrigued me as to where the relationship was, what was going to, again, unfurl and what was the truth of it. And I also thought at that point, oh, maybe something went on between them. And so then I was also, like you, ready for that to happen when she went to his place, happy that it didn't. But then it kind of was like, that's where it sort of stopped short there. And then he, you know, he did the right thing and he told the principal and then he got fired. But then it was just like gone. And I felt there was an opportunity to maybe tease out that what was going on with her a little bit more.
I think it's possible that it's because it's an adaptation of the book. So the book might have had more in there.
Yes.
That just wasn't the time for. Might have even been filmed and then, you know, cut out in the edit. It's just one of those things where they just went, that's probably about as much as we need of that storyline.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks anyway, but bye. Yeah, maybe. But I think there's a, okay, so is, could you have gotten, was his character necessary? Then is the question.
No, probably not. I don't. Yeah, because it's really all very kind of minor subplot. I mean, their meeting up in the restaurant gave another opportunity for us to see more, and really, that was it. That was for, wasn't it?
Exactly. Well, that set up the red herring, right? That set up the, oh, okay, something has gone on. Particularly that line, I don't know if you remember it, where she says, can I call you a bastard now or something? And she said that line. There's a line like that, and I thought, oh, okay, something's gone on between them, because you don't have a teacher-student relationship like that normally, right? Unless there's some type of intimacy, and I don't mean physical, but you know them very well, right? So then I was like, okay, well, there's the setup. And then the payoff was that, okay, she comes back after the rape and he takes care of her, and, oh, this is when we're going to understand why she said that line. And then it didn't really transpire. And then it just sort of went flat, just kind of fizzled out. And yeah, and I don't know. I just don't know whether maybe the mechanically in the script you could have gotten to that conclusion without that character.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There wasn't masses that he did, was there?
No. I liked him. I thought he was good.
Yeah,
and it's nice
to see. Yeah, definitely.
And again, so, if you think about compared to Rox, you know, we were looking at Rox the other day and talking about the school teachers there, and they were fairly typical, weren't they? They were fairly expected in their behavior. So it was really nice in not a good way. So it was nice to see this teacher that just was a good guy who did the right thing.
Yeah.
I guess.
There was that one teacher in Rox that went and knocked on a door, wasn't there? So there was one.
That's right. Actually, yes, you're right. Yeah.
Reach out. But we didn't see much. That was the end of that, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Tokenist.
And then here in the midst.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's funny, isn't it? It's like this, it's a bit, yeah, just that, like maybe it's on the cutting room floor. You never know. Maybe there's a longer scene there somewhere where she talks
about,
I don't know.
Feel obliged to say, they're not all bad.
So, yeah.
Whereas real teachers are like, thanks.
It doesn't go. It raises a good question, doesn't it, about how you create on the screen compelling characters who do a job, like police, like teacher, like nurse, like doctor, those kind of iconic roles that we have ideas about, how you create those in a way that is non-linear, that is complex and interesting in a short space of time when they're support characters.
Yeah.
It's tricky. Yeah. I don't know.
It is true. Yeah. You can't give everyone a thorough arc, can you?
No, you can't give everyone a thorough arc at all. It's a good point. How do you feel about adaptations made into films? Have you got any views on that? Because there's quite a lot at the moment, aren't there? I mean, we've been looking at a few, like we looked at Blonde the other day, and that's an adaptation of a massive novel. This is a novel that's come out of, actually, maybe we should talk about that. Let's talk about this first and then we'll come back to that. So, what's your thought? Have you any thoughts on novel adaptation into films and how that's going?
Well, I mean, apart from the fact that it's all like IP, isn't it? That's just being produced. There's very little that's new. So those of us that are wanting to break in are like, oh,
maybe we need to write a book. Yeah, exactly. Find another way in.
That and then hope it gets turned into
something else. And you get asked to write the screenplay.
She was very particular actually about saying that she was insistent that she wants to write it, and that's because it was so much of it was her story. She wanted to make sure that it was treated right.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. And you would, you know, I think you'd want to contract that into your rights agreement somewhere for sure that happens. It's a big deal at the moment with Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman and their production company. They're doing a lot of that right now, aren't they? Like with Where the Crawdads Sing at the minute. That's the latest one that's out at the movies. And it seems to be a thing. Take a great novel and turn it into a movie, which is good sometimes. What are your thoughts about that what do you see as the sort of, is good and bad of that, or is there any? Is it all just good?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, it'd be nice to get something original, an original screenplay that wasn't based on something else produced. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And the thing is that as long as you can do it well, and in some cases the book is a bit rubbish, but the film's better.
Yeah, I think that's true. Actually,
an example of the ending was awful for the book. Awful.
Yeah,
the film was much better.
See, there's a whole podcast there, isn't there? What films is the where? What book is the film better than the book? I think, and a lot of, you know, I know writers like fiction writers are like, oh no, there's never, the book's always better. It's a hard battle to win, isn't it? But sometimes the films are better. So it's an interesting one, isn't it? And I don't know. I just wonder why. I just wonder why there is so much of the adaptation going on when there are so many great stories. And I understand from the Reese Witherspoon example, they're championing women writers, and that's ace. All behind that, but it's like, well, let's champion the women screenwriters too, because there's a shed load of stories that are ready to go. But yeah, it's funny. I don't know. I mean, I was a bit damaged by Blonde, I think, as an adaptation. I hadn't read it though. That was the thing. And I don't think I would read this book. I don't think with Luckiest Girl Alive, it doesn't incite me to read it. Does it you?
No. I mean, sometimes I do just to see what the difference is. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more kind of the internal monologue, so we can read that more and kind of, because obviously, and that's one of the things we're told never to do voiceovers, and that's one of the reasons we've got voiceovers, because without it we don't get that internal monologue that you get in the book, and that is obviously a failing of films. A difference between films and books is the fact that so much internal monologue, and I never really enjoyed doing the internal monologue. So it's like, you go read a book and be just like, sometimes when I'm reading a book, I just turn the pages to see, oh, look, there's some dialogue. And look, there's some actual action happening.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It does raise the question, doesn't it? Is can you achieve filmically the internal dialogue without using a voiceover? And I think you can. I think if you write good dialogue and good action, you can get across what you need to get across without necessarily having to do voiceovers, because there were a lot of voiceovers in this movie and a lot of flashbacks, like lots and lots and lots of flashbacks. And again, you know, as I do, you know, flashbacks are often looked less favorably on.
It does get rid of the momentum, doesn't it? The forward momentum is
it
lost.
Does.
And then you go back. But if the forward momentum is about you as a viewer discovering what actually happened in the past, then in some ways people can end up feeling like it's the present moment that's interrupting the forward momentum of the past story.
Yes. And I think I felt a little bit like that with this, because it went back and forth loads, right? Loads and loads and loads. And yeah, because, you know, we often talk about how not to write flashbacks, which is not to be tokenistic about them and not to put them in to fill a gap in or to save yourself some exposition. You know, it's sort of and try to use them in fact, try to use them where you create a whole story around the flashback, if you like use it as a mechanic the whole way through the film rather than just something you rely on to help you out because you don't have another way to say it or explain it. And so I think from that point of view, it was good because it was definitely a feature of the film that was used as an actual mechanic to move us through and make us understand. And the history was so important for this film to understand where she was. So from that point of view, I think it was all right. But I don't know. It's a good question around whether you can get the internal monologue without doing voiceover. I don't know.
And there are lots of stories where it's possible to adapt the book into a film and you don't need the voiceover. I think Hunger Games is a brilliant example, actually, of how they're very true to the book with a few, like, exceptions in there and different scenes and you get everything. And because she is quite a complex character, Katniss, that you still manage to get the fact that she's not your typical hero. She's a bit of an anti-hero, like, because she wants to kill the cat at the beginning. That's
right.
But yeah, that you can't help but love her, and they manage to get that internal kind of conflict and there in everything else. And that's partly because the book, I think, is written so well that it comes out in her actions, and it's not just heavily leaning on the internal monologue to show how it is that she's feeling. It's
right, in
everything that she says and does as well.
Interesting, because that is one of the criticisms, or when in these reviews that have criticized this film, they've criticized the film. A couple of them have mentioned that it's actually the weaknesses in this film come about because of the weaknesses in the book. Interesting to consider. So what is it about The Hunger Games that makes it not do that? Like, can you see how they're doing it? How are they making that work? Is it about the complexity of the character?
Yeah.
And
it's also the fact that, for example, I think someone's going to correct me now, but I'm pretty sure. So in the bit where she threatens the cat, that is actually internal monologue in the book.
Right.
But I think in the actual film, I think she says it to the cat that she's...
And that works, right? Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But someone will, because this is off the top of my head. It's been a while since I've watched it. Need a disclaimer across the bottom.
No, exactly. Yeah. Do not trust this fact. We need a stepping into film fact checker.
Yeah,
don't we?
Yeah,
we need like a start a Twitter channel, a fact check. Anyway, yeah. So, but I think that's perfectly reasonable, isn't it? Mm. That from a film point of view is a really good way of they say it out loud. They talk to the cat. Of course you would.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. I'm going to watch it now. I've never seen it.
Oh, really?
No.
I would highly recommend reading the books and also watching the films. My children have only watched the films. Actually, no, that's not fair. Seb has read the first one.
Right. Okay, well, that's good. Okay, well, now I'm intrigued, so maybe I will. And I like that. You know, I like something that intrigues me to watch the film and read the book. And I get, you know, when we were talking about Blonde last week, do not want to read that book, do not want to read this book. And I feel terrible about that, but... actually, that's not my responsibility. That's, you know, that's to make that so. So, you know, what can you do? But still very interesting. And I I don't know whether I would say I enjoyed this movie, but I was definitely intrigued by much of it. And I don't know whether it quite deserves some of the negativity it's received. I think it shines lights on important things, which is always good.
I think so. Agreed. I'm not a huge fan of psychological thrillers. I know they're really big right now, but that's generally, psychological thrillers do tend to put me on edge anyway, and usually because certainly a large part of the plot is to do with violence against women, and it's not my go-to downtime thing to do is to read about violence against women. So that's generally why psychological thrillers make me go,
That's a really good point, you know, because I quite like thrillers. In fact, I do like thrillers a lot, but I also I went to a crime writers festival just because, you know, why not? I'm not a crime writer, but I kind of like books. Someone was talking, I can't even remember who it was, but they were great, whoever they were. So if that was you and you're watching, you were amazing. And they were saying, and I thought this point was fascinating, that when you read crime thrillers, it's really common to have a naked woman wash up somewhere or a naked woman found somewhere. And this whole trope about the naked woman murdered, killed, found. Think right back to Twin Peaks, you know, like Laura Palmer wrapped up in plastic washes up on the side of the lake. You know, it's a trope that we repeatedly use or is repeatedly used in crime thrillers and novels forever. And as women, you don't even think about it. And when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, of course that happens. You don't often find the hot naked guy
on
the beach, right? And it's kind of like, well, yeah, why does that trope not exist, but this does? And you're right, here we have again this sort of the ease with which we portray in films the, you know, these terrible things happening to women, and you don't even think twice, do you? You look at it and you go, well, that's terrible, but you're almost immune to it.
Yeah.
Aren't we, in a way? You know, it's so expected, I think, which is
normalized. Which
it is normalized, yeah.
No thanks.
The disappointing thing about it. Mm. Yes. So, anything else you would like to add that we haven't talked about? Any particular points we haven't covered?
I think I have covered everything in my notes.
How would you wrap it up? Would you watch it again?
No, but again, that's psychological thrillers, and violence against women is not my usual kind of fare for my free time. But although she does, like, as I've said, she does have agency, and that it's not the rape that leads to her having this like life, that a trajectory, it's actually that stunts her from doing what she wants, and it reinforces to her that she needs to keep everybody happy. And so I very much value the message that is portraying. And it's definitely of the type, it's a really good example of how to do it.
Quick one, something that did come up that we didn't touch on when we were talking about I thought it was kind of a intriguing choice around how even though the guys were gang raped her, which was terrible, her friends were the ones that ended up doing the shooting. And I actually thought that friend of hers, the guy with the curly hair, whose name I can't remember, it really surprised me that he was the one that had done the shooting. Because he played Arthur Finneman, that's right, Thomas Babuski is his name, and Babuska, and he was very good. But I actually thought of all of the characters in her life, we must talk about one other very quickly. He was one that seemed to have some integrity. He was the one that said to her, you need to out these people, you know, and I guess, you know, and I thought, I thought, I'm not sure if that was particularly fair to represent the social outcasts as the ones that are the killers, you know, because it, again, it's a bit tropey, isn't it? You know, here we go again, the guys on the outside, you know, particularly the friend of theirs, the one with the glasses who had that terrible thing happen to him in the woods.
Yeah.
Doesn't fit the idea or the image of a guy that you'd think would turn killer. Like, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into that. I don't know this, you know, the sociology kind of stuff, but, you know, it was, I just thought that was really interesting. And I didn't, yeah. And the other thing I wanted to quickly chat with you about was her friend, you know, her blonde friend. And she also was one of the only people in her life that was actually genuinely nice, who came from that other side of the tracks, if you like. And I felt she could have been perhaps a stronger figure, because I liked the fact that she was there consistently and she did seem to be a really good person. And I wondered whether that could have, I thought there was an opportunity to maybe develop that relationship out a little bit more, because she was the only thing, the only person that had come with her all through that high school thing. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have a view on her in any way?
She was very much just a small side character, wasn't she? And whether or not,
I don't know. It just floated through my mind.
There needed to be something more there. There wasn't really a moment of them ever. I mean, maybe that's what she was there for, that for once, rather than there being an antagonistic relationship, it was like, actually, it's possible to have friends who just support you. And there you go. I am giving you that. Here's a good friendship, healthy friendship that just is there as represented. And it is nice to see. Not that we saw lots of it, but.
Well, yeah, because there wasn't a lot of depth with anyone, really, was it? You know, character-wise. But maybe that was it. Maybe it was about, we've got your protagonist. This is an inner journey. This is, you know, personal drama. Okay, get that. And the rest are supporting characters, maybe. Yeah. It sort of felt that way, didn't it?
It did, definitely did.
Anyway, so sorry to have traumatized you making you watch that movie. I don't know what's next on the slate. I think the next one is, I think Lost in Translation is next.
Yeah, it is, and I don't think I'm on that one. So, yeah.
And it is one of my favourite movies in the whole world. Yeah. So if anybody disses it, I'm going to get really upset. I'm just putting that out there right now.
I've heard some of my opinions on it, so I'm going to just...
Yes. Look, if anyone starts on the Bill Murray thing, I don't want to know. Okay. Nobody diss Bill Murray. Anyway, we'll get to that later. But thank you so much, Lorna, for joining me. And thank you for watching this. I appreciate you doing that. You've had a couple of tough watches. Yeah. So I appreciate you. We'll get some good things happening after this. More fun. More enjoyment.
That's the rom-com one I'm really looking forward to.
I know rom-coms. Yeah, that's a little teaser we're going to be. Is the rom-com dead? I can't wait for that. I think that we'll need to make that like a 3-hour podcast. Yeah. Like a half-day workshop, I think, to work our way through that. Anyway, thank you very much, Lorna, and thank you very much, everybody else. If you have enjoyed watching the podcast, you know you can find us on anywhere you get your podcasts, or check us out on social media. Thanks very much. See you next time. Bye-bye.